Senate Trade Economic Committee to order at this time. We have a very heavy agenda today. Today's date is April 19. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 404. Who is going to testify on this bill? Anyone here?
Economic Development?
Yes, going to come on over. So if you want to come together.
I need to run down to unfortunately to transportation. It's going to take a long time.
Pretty good.
Very good.
See you.
Okay. That's who is going to speak first?
Chairman Lin, members of the committee. I'm Mike Burton, Assistant Director of the Oregon Economic Development Department.
Welcome.
Thank you. Basically, we have very little to add since our appearance at the last hearing. At that point, we told you that there was one issue that had not been resolved and that was still hanging. We had a meeting with representatives of the Association of Oregon Counties, Oregon Public Courts Association, and League of Oregon Cities to discuss that issue and have come up with two amendments to the bill that was presented to you at that time.
Ready?
Those are in Section 3, which is on the version you have, it's numbered 2B. But Section 3, Paragraph 3, would add the phrase, in collaboration with counties. So it would read, the department, in collaboration with counties, shall establish regions, and it goes on. The other more substantive change is in Section 11. Section 11 is on page 11, now it's 2J.
Okay.
This is Section 11B, sub C, sub 2.
Okay.
And basically what we've done is we've agreed that each biennium, the department shall write rules. Those rules shall be developed in conjunction with the local government partners and will provide an opportunity for input by any interested parties in the program.
Okay.
There was some discussion about whether there's significant discussion about whether or not there should be funds held centrally, and it's the conclusion of the local government summit in conjunction with the department that we would revisit that question each biennium, and all of us would come to the agreement on what that would mean.
Okay.
That's all we have to present to you at this time. We'd be happy to answer questions
Mr.
Chair, for the record, Gordon Foltz with the Association of Oregon Counties. We were part of the summit that was just mentioned by Mike, and we agree to the language that's proposed before you, and we're on board to have the bill move forward.
Okay. Any? Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong, Oregon Public Courts Association. We've looked at the amendments. The bill should pass.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities.
Ditto. Seems like everyone agrees on this one. Any objections from anybody?
Something wrong, Mr.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Is there any other person like to testify on Senate Bill 404 at this time?
Mr. Chair, I think Terry only wanted to testify on Senate Bill 404.
Yes. I asked him to come here around 3:05, apparently. Oh, Senator. Senator, welcome here. Glad to have you with us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ted Ferrioli. I just came before you to talk about Senate Bill 404 and the -2s because I wanted to reaffirm the need to focus our attention for economic development on rural and distressed communities. And I am hoping that the -2s reaffirm our regional partnership goals and objectives, and that they focus on the essential and regional economic and community development priorities of the communities, and that they contain some specific directions for the submission of regional plans for investment and distribution of the funds, and that they require collaboration with counties and cities and the distressed communities that we're trying to help. So I'm hopeful that the committee looks at these dash two amendments and works through them and comes to the conclusion that we're still on the right track for aiding rural and distressed communities. We are also looking very hard at the whole economic development conundrum because of the budgetary squabbles that we're seeing that are continuing in this building. And it's just one of those situations that all of us are aware of. There aren't enough resources to fund every issue as fully as we might like. We're here to set priorities, and the priorities are always a topic of hot discussion and debate in this building. I just wanted to reaffirm that there have been folks in Oregon that have been working on rural and distressed community economic development issues for the last 3 years. And we're hopeful that this session is the one that will bring us forward to a program that will, in fact, empower the distressed communities wherever they are with the economic development dollars.
Thank you very much. And Senator Ferrioli, I do appreciate the job you are doing, especially in eastern Oregon, southern part. There's a lot of high unemployment, even double digit. We are aware of that. I hope this Senate will fall for that to hopefully to get there with this one if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Senator Ferrioli, are you comfortable with the committee moving forward with the version of the bill before us? Or are you going to be seeking amendments to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I am in the process of working at a set of amendments that I guess you could look at as a Plan B. They are essentially predicated on the theory that it may not be possible to fully fund the governor's proposal for economic development for Oregon. And I think all of us are looking at other priorities that may be as important or in some people's minds more important than this issue. And I just want to make sure that the broadest possible range of alternatives is before the committee to move forward. And if that means an adjustment of the work plan for economic development, then that's what it means. So I'm going to be bringing forward some amendments that may be a little bit different than the dash twos, but would be specific about what we think might still be doable under any configuration that other budgetary issues take, K-12, for instance. So since we haven't closed on the magic number, we don't know what other agencies should be expecting in terms of their programs. I just want to be ready so that there's a tool available to meet the important objective of economic diversification in distressed communities.
Okay.
Thanks for your question.
Okay.
Senator Ferrioli, would it be fair to also say that you're willing to work with the department, the Oregon Economic Development Department, and possibly the governor's economic development staff towards the language for that amendment or amendments?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I've asked for direction from the department, and we have been meeting pretty much continuously with the governor's staff on the livability agenda so that there's clear understanding about the fact that we're all now in the process of dealing with politics as the art of the possible, and we want to be sure that we can do everything that's possible.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Would you stay for a while? Mike, could you come over here again? And did you hear some of the concerns of Senator expressed, and how did you respond to that?
Senator Lynn, members of the committee, I share Senator Ferrioli's concerns. We're truly concerned about the level of funding and our ability to deliver economic development. The budget that has been presented as part of the governor's budget and will be considered by Ways and Means as part of a package that is trying to address the economic development needs of the state of Oregon. I've not been party to the discussions with Senator Ferraioli, so I can't speak to the details of those discussions, but we are concerned. We are hopeful that we'd be charged with bringing all of Oregon into the recovery that the cities have enjoyed. We feel that this bill represents the regional part of that effort, and we're hoping that we pass it out and get the authority to go forth and do economic development on a regional basis.
You think the 4-2 amendment will address some of the concerns that the Senator Ferraioli mentioned, if not all?
Senator Lim, members of the committee, my understanding on Senator Ferraioli's remarks was that he's concerned about total budget figures. Senate Bill 404 does not include a number for funding. The governor's budget proposes roughly $20 million for the programs that would be enacted as a result of this bill. It's our feeling that what that does is return us to the level of funding that we experienced in the biennium before last. So we were looking for that level of funding in order to restore the program to a significant level of activity for rural and distressed Oregon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, there is obviously a Ways and Means consideration to be made in Senate Bill 404, and that may be the appropriate place for us to deal with the any other considerations that we may have to bring to this issue based on the availability of funding. But I also am hopeful that we can have a full appropriation for the rural and distressed communities that are intended to be addressed in this bill.
Okay, in this 404.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator.
Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to come before your committee and your kind words.
Thank you. Any more questions or comments?
Thank you, members.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Is there any other person like to testify on Senate Bill 404 at this point? If not, we will close a public hearing on Senate Bill 404. And so,
what's the choice? I guess we'll move out this one next.
I think we need to hold on to it for a while.
You think so?
Uh-huh. Hold on to it for a few days.
Okay. Okay. We'll let the hold on the work session for a while. We'll actually have a talk with the Senator Ferraioli on this issue again. We'll bring it back, though. Okay. With that, let's close the public hearing 404, Senate Bill 404. And then I'd like to open public hearing of SJR 19. And anyone here from elect? Okay. Okay, Carol, why don't you give us what the SJR 19 does first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Senate Joint Resolution 19 is a resolution that declares Portland to be an international city for the 21st century. This bill has no revenue impact, and it has no fiscal impact. Neither is there a subsequent referral on the bill. By way of background, I was informed that it is not typical for states to designate cities by a text name, but that it would not be something that would be objectionable. And the gentleman who gave me this information is the international manager for the National League of Cities, and he also told me that Portland and the specific characteristics that it has would clearly identify it as an international city on the West Coast. We have, for the committee, received a letter from the Port of Portland, which will enter into the record, stating that the Port of Portland appreciates the efforts of Senator Lim to pass this resolution and urges the committee's support of the bill. And there is one witness
Okay.
Signed up, who would like to testify.
Okay. Carol Winkler from the Mayor Tax Office. We'd like to welcome you.
Thank you.
As you know, that just state your name and then proceed.
My name is Carol Winkle from the Mayor Beer Tax Office, and I'm here to present a letter from the...
Can you speak closer to the mic?
My name is Carol Winkle from Mayor Veracat's office, and I'm here to present a letter from Mayor Katz to the committee.
Okay.
On behalf of the City of Portland, it is with great pleasure that I support your resolution to declare Portland an international city for the 21st century. Although I am unable to testify in person due to prior commitments on my schedule, I hope my absence in no way detracts from my strong endorsement of your resolution. We are proud of our diverse cultural community and internationally focused economy and are committed to making Portland a city of the future. The City of Portland, with the support of the private sector, has been expanding our international development opportunities and look forward to seeing the continued internationalization of our community. Portland's recently introduced strategy, Internationalizing Greater Portland 2, includes priority strategies such as expanding international air service, securing funding to deepen the Columbia River Navigational Channel, and expanding the Oregon Convention Center. In addition, our community embraces cultural diversity by promoting international exchanges and our sister city relations. Last year, the Cinco de Mayo Festival, sponsored by the Portland-Guadalajara Sister City Association, was rated the top festival in North America from a field of 8,000 by the New Jersey-based Events Alliance. This summer, Suzhou Garden Artisans will arrive to begin construction of the largest classical Chinese garden in North America. I appreciate this opportunity to endorse your resolution that will increase the awareness of our internationalization efforts here and abroad, and applaud your work to enhance and add character to our wonderful city with this designation.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions, any comments? Okay. Thank you very much. Would you please our best regards to the mayor and appreciate for the support that the letter given to us.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. Could you have the copy of the letter? Yes. Yeah. Is there any other person I'd like to testify on SJR, that's the 19, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, SJR 19. If not, we will, this is option. Let's see. We'll close the public hearing at SJR 19 and let's open workshop in SJR 19.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 19 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordon moves SJR 19 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, call the roll.
Senator Copeland?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher? Senator Hartley?
Aye.
Senator?
Aye. The SJR 19 is passed. And this one. Is there any volunteer to carry this? SJR
19?
Yes. Okay, Senator Gordley will carry this here. I will be also having some supporting in that speech. Okay, thank you. Did I close the public session? Oh. Yes, I'd like to close the work session, SJR 22, and then open up the, let me see. Oh, I'd like to close the work session SJR 19. And then I open a public hearing SJR 22. This is very controversial. And we have some people to testify.
Mr. Chair, this wouldn't be half as controversial if I could understand your explanation of seeing Tom McCall's signs and deciding to stay in Oregon.
Okay.
If I understood that, I think I'd be in total support.
Okay. Glad to hear that. Would you, Carol, would you explain to me what the SJR Senate is without?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Resolution 22 is a measure to direct the Department of Transportation to place a sign at each highway entrance to Oregon stating you are welcome to visit Oregon, but please don't stay. This bill has no revenue impact. However, a fiscal impact statement has been issued. And the fiscal impact that has been noted by legislative fiscal is $88,000, $66,000 for the initial installation of signs at 30 points of entry across the state, and $2,000 per year per sign for maintenance, so an additional $12,000 maintenance in the second year of the biennium. I think that's
it. Does it have a referral to the Ways and Means?
It does not have a subsequent referral, no.
I think it should go to the Ways and Means, I guess.
With that fiscal?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So here are your...
Okay. Why don't you give us your governor,
former
governor, a TS letter we have. So we are going to read it and adopt it as an official document.
Actually, Senator, Mr. Chair, we have three letters that you've received for this committee. We have a letter prepared by Julie Curtis, the Assistant Director of Oregon Tourism.
She's supporting the CF-22.
Mm-hmm. And you have a letter from Joe Del Sandro from the Portland, Oregon Visitors Association, which is an official part of the record.
Okay.
And you also have a letter from former Governor Victor Chia, who specifically asked that his letter be read into the record.
Okay. Thank you. All of the letters, you said in support of us in opposition.
Senator...
I can read the first sentence of the Chia's letter. That might explain it a little bit.
They are generally in opposed.
Opposed? Okay. Thank you.
Would you like...
Mr. Chair...
Yeah,
I wonder if I might explain the word generally.
That's a general concept. Would you like Senator or former Governor Atiyah's letter to be read?
That letter should be read.
All right.
Maybe not all of it. For time's sake, we'll just read the one letter since she has been the governor in the past.
I won't read as fast as they read on the Senate floor.
Okay.
Dear Senator Lim and members of the committee, the concept of reviving come visit but don't stay is a shocking example of the terrible effects of term limitations that erased a huge amount of institutional memory. There were those, including myself, who well remember the times in Oregon when we had the second or third highest unemployment rate in the United States, reaching 12.6%. There were those of us who well recall the impediment among people in the United States and around the world, who thought Oregon did not want business to come or expand in Oregon because of that statement. It was a very heavy anchor for economic development and for diversification. To say that I oppose the restoration of that infamous quotation would be putting it too politely and mildly. I worked too hard for 8 long years to erase that slogan, and to even hear it mentioned disturbs me more than I can say. If you are interested in continuing the economic strength of our state and providing jobs for Oregonians, then you will immediately put this idea to sleep. If, on the other hand, you do not think it is important for Oregonians to be assured of a solid and dependable future, and that we should return to the moribund days when that quotation was in high fashion, then you will do the unforgivable and vote for the idea.
Okay, that's it.
That's it.
That's a strong word.
Very strong.
Okay. Let me see. We have more than several people like to testify on this one. And is there that a person came from more than 100 miles? Okay, then if not...
Oh, they're driving the borders right
now. Okay. Let me see.
Maybe we could get back in time, I think.
Okay. Roy, J.
Yeah.
Okay, and OCVFN, and African American Chamber.
Yeah.
There you go. Is he the president?
Mm-hmm. Last time I checked.
Okay, welcome. I think you are the first one to testify.
Well, we came together as a team, Senator Lindbergh. This is the rest of my extended family.
Okay.
I figured we'd all be up here together, and I was just going to let Julie go ahead and start out, and then we're just going to pick it up, and hopefully by the time we get finished, I'll beat up on you so much you'll just understand why this thing needs to get...
Okay.
Okay, Julie, go ahead.
Okay, Julie.
That's right. Don't take long.
You know the procedure, please state your name first.
Thank you. My name is Julie Curtis. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Tourism Commission, and we are the state agency responsible for promoting travel to Oregon, as I think you probably know. On behalf of our 9-member commission and our executive director, Todd Davidson, we'd like to go on the record opposing SJM 22, which we feel inaccurately portrays how Oregonians feel about visitors. Tourism is a more than $5 billion industry in Oregon and employs 73,000 people. Over the past decade, the Tourism Commission and our industry have worked very, very hard to grow this industry in Oregon, to welcome our visitors, and we feel that erecting signs at borders to asking people to visit but not stay would really serve to undermine all the positive work we've accomplished over the past decade plus with our partners throughout the state. You might be familiar with our state slogan, which is Oregon, things look different here. We specifically changed that slogan in the late 1980s as a result of our previous slogan, which was Oregon, you're more than welcome. We felt that was apologizing for the fact that you didn't used to be welcome in the mid-80s, so we changed our slogan specifically to be more encompassing and welcoming to Oregon's visitors. In addition, we've embarked on a visitor industry awareness campaign, producing a kit that helps communities welcome visitors. I've passed out some bumper stickers, I think, to all of you. There are decals that go in stores. We have hundreds of businesses throughout the state that display these stickers that say, Oregon welcomes you. We feel that these signs would certainly undermine that message that our industry has out there. How has the public responded to this proposed legislation? You probably know that Newsweek, in their April 12th issue, mentioned this legislation. We've had visitor bureaus report to us that people have canceled their trips as a result of hearing about this on the national and regional level. And Oregon residents have certainly written letters to their local newspapers saying that this is not something that they feel reflects our state. Senator Lim and committee members, I'm sure it's probably not a surprise to you that the Oregon Tourism Commission would oppose SJM 22. We still fight former Governor Tom McCall's Visit But Don't Stay legacy at trade shows internationally and domestically when we market Oregon. What you might not have considered and I would like to bring up today is how this could potentially impact Oregon products that feature Oregon's name, our food products, wood products, clothing, and more. And wouldn't it be a horrible shame if this discussion were to undermine these businesses' ability to sell their products outside our borders because of this negative publicity that we've heard about over the past several weeks. So we urge you not to let this bill go any farther than this hearing for Oregon, for our visitor industry, and for our reputation. And thank you for listening to my comments today.
Okay. Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for being here this afternoon. And for the record, could you please indicate which people or groups have canceled trips or have indicated that they're no longer planning to come because of what they've heard?
Sure. Chair Lim and Senator Gordley, we have heard specifically from the Convention and Visitor Bureau in Corvallis, Oregon, that they had several calls from individual travelers, not groups, saying that they were offended by this and felt that they weren't welcome in the Corvallis community and in Oregon and were not going to come. We have a toll-free number that the Tourism Commission contracts with a company to answer our toll-free line. We've had a couple of calls, not a lot, but a couple of calls from individuals saying that they felt this was arrogant and that they wouldn't feel welcome coming to our state. So while it hasn't been hundreds, we certainly have gotten calls from throughout our state from organizations that have heard this feedback.
And a follow-up question, what does the Newsweek article say about this legislation. I missed the article.
Okay. Chair Lindman and Senator Gordley, it's in the perspective section, which is mainly sound bites and quotes from people from around the country, and it quotes Senator Lim talking about legislation, and it's just a little, about four sentences.
Can you read it?
Well, sure. It says,
quote,
"You are welcome to visit Oregon, but please don't stay," end quote. The message that would be posted on freeway signs at the state's borders under a measure proposed by State Senator John Lim, an advocate of managed growth.
Okay. And if I may just ask one other follow-up question, seeking your comment. From your position, then, is it accurate to say that you are now having to do some damage control? Is that an overstatement or...
Chairman and Senator Gordley, not at all. It's when this was associated with Oregon 15 or 20 years ago, we are still living that down as we go around the country and around the world to try to encourage visitation to Oregon, some places more than others, and we've worked very hard to bury that image. It's still there, and I think when this came out in the press and got so much attention, which I think surprised maybe everybody, it just rekindles and refuels that attitude, and yes, we are doing damage control.
Thank you.
I just comment, having, was in state government at that time, and particularly during the Attia era when he was trying to fight that image constantly. I was traveling representing the state at that time, and there were times when I was out of country, in Australia or other places, and, I'd be identified as the official from the state of Oregon, and they knew that. I mean, it carried over, and it's just frightening, and I have the greatest respect for my chair, and I know what he's thinking of, but I guess have to say is that what sixth generation of my family live in this state. I'm appalled. I generally think, with all due respect, I think it's the people who've come to Oregon and who want to close the doors afterwards that are probably saying this often. Those of us, my heritage, the covered wagon crew, so when we came here, and I just think it's kind of appalling, and I really want to put this behind us as quickly as possible. I really do. I said, with all due respect to my chairman, I welcome people to the state of Oregon. I mean, I think we have to manage our growth. We have to be concerned about schools and transportation. Those should be the high priorities that this legislative assembly should be looking at. The growth is going to come. We have something here, but let's be sure that we have a little vision so that when people do arrive, that we do manage that growth a little bit. We may end up getting more people from Ireland over here even too, and so I want to be sure we're prepared for that in the future. So I guess I just would hope that more power, I would hope that you're taking out, I'd love to see some full page ads in the Los Angeles papers and such papers.
No.
Letting them know. I agree with the damage card. I think we've got to let them know that that's not our message at all. We are very welcoming and we want tourists and like to have them come.
Okay. I say the caucus.
Mr. Chair, I think Tom McCall has been given credit for the original slogan, and I think actually when the Native Americans found out that Senator Duncan's family was coming via wagon train, they developed it originally. So I wanted to set that part of the story straight. The other comment I want to make is that I don't think that the Tourism Commission would be so opposed to this if we just limited it so that they were signs facing going out of Eugene all the way around it. That's another consideration. And the third is, I think the Oregonian did the best job on this, which was considering changing the Oregonian considered changing the slogan to Oregon. Yes, this is our state legislature. So I'll shut up now.
Okay. You can think through that one a bit. I heard some time ago the American Indians send a letter
to the President Johnson that be careful immigration law because we were not careful.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Anyway, let me have one question. You mentioned some kind of a damage control, and I'm glad you are doing something if there were real damages. But since Governor McCall said in his famous interview with Teddy Drinkwater, I haven't seen any signs of slowing down people moving into other states. And do you have any solid, some statistics or proof that after that he mentioned that people coming to our states have been slowed down somehow? But apparently at this point, more people moved into our state than any other state in the nation.
Chair Lim, I don't have any statistics on that. I think we obviously all realize that we've had tremendous growth in population in Oregon. I guess from a tourism perspective and an industry perspective, it just doesn't feel friendly and it doesn't feel Oregonian for us to say, you can visit, but please go home. And I think while I don't have the statistics, we've worked very, very hard to grow the tourism industry. We've seen it almost double in the past decade, and I think that's a result of a lot of the hard work at the state level and at the local level with our tourism partners. And to create another hurdle for us to go over, I think would set us back, and we would probably see that tourism slow down.
You know, my comment is that the Governor McCall exactly understood what he was saying. If you accept it as it is, literally, it sounds like a negative tone for sure. But as I read his mind, he used this famous sign language as a marketing tool. And everywhere Governor McCall goes in out of the state, people asking, what do you have a special? You don't want us to come. It's even intrigued their mind even to come to our state because they think we have something special. I think I use your saying psychological advantages. It is not necessarily anti-Californian or anti-any outsiders. This is just for Oregonian what we have and to promote, advertise what we have. That's my sense. Okay. Who's going to be the next person to question about?
Okay. Well, let me respond to what you said here. I know you said it.
Roy.
Oh, okay. Roy J., president of almost everything except for this commission right now, but African-American Chamber of Commerce, Oregon Convention, Visitor Services, and president-elect of Washington County Convention and Visitors Bureau. What Governor Call may have made reference to years ago, that may have worked before, but it doesn't work anymore. We are in 1999. All of our jobs here is to promote convention and tourism. That means, for those of you that are not out there on the front line, our job is to bring people into Oregon, make them feel good, have them spend a whole lot of money, send them home broke and happy. Now, that's what we do on a day-to-day basis. And we do it quite well, considering the little funding that we do get to go out here and do this. On a national basis, when we're out there competing with other cities, any little small thing like this that's in this magazine, you better believe that some other city is going to use it to their advantage to sway a 2,000-person convention or a 500-person convention to another city. We cannot afford to lose dime one right now. I'm trying to figure out exactly what I'm doing here today because I'm hoping this thing is going to die a natural death and go on its way. We went through a lot big process several years ago when we were out trying to promote conventions and people thought that this was the land of skinheads and neo-Nazism and things of that nature, and we had to try and overcome those barriers. The diversity of people that are coming here as tourists and particularly convention delegates are starting to become even more and more, and we have to keep our doors open. You know, I don't mind if you want to put the signs up with one condition. They go behind the tree, way in the back bush, 50 miles off the freeway. That way nobody can see them. This is real important because I can't afford to have any real disadvantages with the small amount of money that we have to market. And I'm sure that Joe will address that as well. And we're trying to make this state very diverse, we need to have this cultural advantage. Right now we are sitting in on a gold mine. California is losing billions, let me repeat, billions of dollars every year because of anti-affirmative action. That means conventions will no longer go there. Seattle just passed anti-affirmative action. They kissed goodbye to the National Medical Association, $3 million economic impact, and it keeps rolling. That means, ladies and gentlemen, there's only one West Coast city that is open. That's Portland. So the signs, I mean, is putting signs up, Senator Lynn, is like shooting ourselves in the foot. We need every dollar that we can get. We want to send them home happy and broke.
Okay.
Okay.
Questions?
Yes. Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Roy J., for being here this afternoon. You talked briefly about an image that we've had to overcome as Oregonians that was tied to some of the skinhead activity, the white supremacist organizing that is known to go on in this state, but also in the five states surrounding.
Correct.
Can you talk about how you've done that? What have you had to do proactively to overcome that image? And
well, what we've done, Senator Gordley, is not just myself, but through POVA and the state and some of the and private enterprise is trying to show that Portland and Oregon is very diverse. We bring in people, various meeting planners and organizations that are booking Portland, people of color, and all these people come to spend money. Now, also at the same time, not just from a racial standpoint, several years ago we had a situation where there was a measure that was almost ready to pass, thank God it didn't, that was anti-gay and things of that nature. That the economic impact, when you talk about billions of dollars, I mean, we got letters from everybody. The state, the Librarian Association, you name it, everybody says, fine, go ahead and pass it. Not with our money. We won't send people here. And we can't afford to be in that position. So we have tried to restructure, including videos that show people of color. You know, some people back east actually think we actually ride horses and covered wagons. Now that could apply to the Duncan family to this day. But I'm not sure, you know. Is that right, Vern? And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we're trying to be the first there.
Here
that's right. G-A-V-L, I told you, let me sit at this table like this. but we have really tried to make sure that we keep the doors open. And that's the name of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, Joe, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Joe D'Alessandro, and I'm the President and CEO of the Portland, Oregon Visitor Association, and Mr. Chairman of the committee, it's my pleasure to be here. The Portland, Oregon Visitor Association is made up of over 1,000 businesses and organizations from across the state that are members, and our mission is to promote the visitor industry and economic development of this state. There's no question that Oregon's economy is more diverse and stronger than it was 10 or 20 years ago. Unfortunately, as many of us know, it's still very fragile. And we need to do everything we can that fosters a positive, welcoming, and productive environment to do business. And I think that this measure is just the opposite. I think it does cause harm. I think it has already caused harm. We have received numerous calls, emails. In fact, we forwarded a copy of one of the emails we received to the members of this committee from visitors that say, we don't need to spend our discretionary money there if you don't want us. We'll take it somewhere else. And it's already caused us harm. There's been millions of dollars invested in this industry by the public sector and the private sector. We can't afford to do anything at all that will hurt that investment and hurt the long-term growth for this state. It's just too important. I wanted to mention one thing, Senator Lim, about your comment about Governor McCall's true message. And I believe that the legacy of Tom McCall is something that we enjoy as Oregonians today. And his vision, I think, is something that we can still benefit from. Unfortunately, if you're sitting in Denver or Des Moines or Phoenix, you don't know the whole story. You listen to the soundbite. The soundbite you hear is that we don't want you to come. And that's the damage that we're having to deal with. And hopefully we can get beyond this and commit to projecting an image that Oregonians are welcoming, we are friendly, and we do want people to come and spend their money here. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? So can I ask one question? According to the study done, we understand if the population and growth in metro area, especially in Willamette Valley area, is expecting maybe in the 25 years or later, 1 million people supposed to come here. That I would ready for that. you know, that what I heard and understand in California, Los Angeles area, that the agriculture was used to be a number one industry. Right now, it's that it, all of the agriculture industry is gone. And then, you know, the housings and the freeways and the whole thing, smogs and water, whole things come to it. And we want to make sure that the, we need to have some plans and a roadmap that when the people are coming in, how are we going to accommodate it. I think this sign measure is not necessarily anti-anything. It is a wake-up call for every one of our states to have some kind of a plan. And how do you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate that, and I certainly believe that the members of Oregon's tourism industry will fight valiantly to protect the quality of life that we enjoy as Oregonians, because that's what sets us apart. We don't want to become a state of sprawl and something that you can find anywhere else. What makes us unique is that we do have a quality of life that we could celebrate and share. A very important distinction that I want to make, though, is you cannot confuse population growth and tourism. They're not the same thing. People move because of jobs, because of family pressures, because of persecution, because of a variety of other opportunities, not because they're a tourist. Most of our tourists come here to have a good time. They're going to go somewhere else the next time. They're not necessarily going to move. So just because somebody's a tourist does not mean that they're looking at real estate while they're here. The fact of the matter is most people happily live where they are and are just using their discretionary dollars to have a good time and entertainment. We are in the process of that. We want to preserve the character of Oregon because that's what sets us apart in the marketplace. But please don't confuse tourism with population growth because they're two totally separate issues.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, Chair, you make a very good point. The population is going to grow, and we're going to have to grow. And I guess I'm critical of us as a legislative assembly and the general public, too. Because I think there is a pothole mentality out there. If you see a pothole, you say, we really need to fix that pothole. But sometimes people aren't looking to see what's under those roads and see down the road 20 years from now when we really expect this influx to come in. I mean, if we fail to start acting now, we have put a terrible burden on those who will follow us. And so if we're worried about every dime here right now, which we have to be concerned about, I understand that, think of the impact we're making for those down the road. I frankly wish we had, I knew the governor very well, he was a very good friend, very misdirected statement he made at one time, I think, but I would like to see the rest of his stuff. He really did have a vision on many things. And I guess I'm not seeing the vision right now. And I'm sorry I'm using this platform, but I harped it in our caucus and every place else that we've got to get away from the pothole mentality and start looking the visionary kinds of things. And I do concur that we have to separate two things. You're talking about the visitors, which may be the immediate pothole, I guess you might say, to get the people here. But if you don't do that, you're not going to be able to deal with the future, too. So I understand your separation of the growth and also the economic impact of tourism, which we really need to let people know. I mean, it's kind of like you're coming to my house. I want you to know you're welcome at my house at any time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I may hope underneath you don't stay forever. I'm certainly not going to put a sign at the door.
You know, I believe that we need to develop and bring tourism, people bring it in with at any cost. I think we need to change that mentality. Mm-hmm. And then we need to look at some important that environmental issues over economic development. I think it's about time. So I hope that is also the message. Anyway, that is my comment. And Robert, Scott West, what's the OLA mean?
Oregon Lodging Association.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Scott West with the Oregon Lodging Association, and I'll keep my comments brief. We represent over 1,100 hotels, motels, resorts, bed and breakfasts, and RV parks throughout the state. And essentially, we're here and we echo. I could go on and speak to the same things that the folks have said here today. But but we are one of the prime benefactors of the industry, as you might imagine, and so we're very concerned about the nature of the industry, and certainly echo the comments that all have made here today that the effort has been very diligent and long time coming to reap the sort of rewards that the state has seen here in the last few years. And as our members are continually working hard in conjunction with the Provost and Tourism Commission and Roy's organizations to put together a good product to welcome folks and let them have a pleasurable experience here in the state. Anecdotally, I just want to add one comment that happened here just over this last weekend back in Nashville, where the gathering of the National Association of Hotel and Motel Operators gathered. We had a contingent of folks that were board members that are active in the organization attend, and they had been barely on the ground and barely in Nashville when they were met with some of their peers commenting on this issue before you here today, and they were encouraging our group to come back and to support this effort because, in their own words, it was sending more business to them. Mm-hmm. So that was a first-hand experience that we had that we just experienced over the weekend, and so with that, I'll leave you with that. Once again, our organization stands in opposition to the measure.
Okay. Any questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, I would like to thank all the panelists, and Joe D'Alessandro is one of my constituents, and we are working on another project together, which, ironically, is to bring the National Indian Gaming Association convention to Portland in the year 2000. And again, we'll keep that little project on track, but appreciate you being here this afternoon to speak to this particular issue.
Thank you. Thank you for your support. Okay, my comment, I'd like to make it again. With this assigned deal, I got a lot of people calling me, like emails and fax and telephone calls. Some people think I'm an angel. Some people think I'm a devil. Some people say I'm a hypocrite. Since I come from Korea myself, and as an immigrant, you came and you tried to shut other people out coming over here, you know. And even some people said, go back to your own country. You know, I want to make sure I'm not going back. Okay, I'm here to stay. I want to go there. So I think it's appropriate to sharing with you. And at the same time, I feel the same, the governor of Tom Mecca went through when he said that, that I feel the same pain that he did went through after he said that, you know. But I don't think it's all negative. I'm not saying it is all positive. I think with this, we might be able to have some prominent place in the nation and around the world. It is a special place. Okay. Anyway, yes,
sir. I think, you know, we do a lot of compromise in this building, so maybe we should look at an amendment that says, you are welcome to visit Oregon, but don't run for lieutenant governor. We do that? Okay. Try that out.
How about welcome to Oregon, we accept all major credit cards.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, Mr. Chair, well, one of the things that I'm really struck by as we've been having this conversation for the last few minutes is the irony, because in SJR 19, we're declaring Portland as an international city for the 21st century, yet in SJR 22, we're talking about signs at the borders welcoming people to visit and asking them not to stay. And then 2 days from now, we'll be all engaged in the Day of Acknowledgement activities, which acknowledge a time in Oregon's history that we definitely want to we want to acknowledge, but we want to say that it is a part of our past. There was a time when we actually had laws on the books that said certain people, African Americans, cannot reside in the state. And there was a time when we had active Klan organizing around, you know, which people could actually live here. They didn't want Jews, and they didn't want Catholics, they didn't want black folks. So when we start to talk about this kind of issue, it conjures up a part of our past, our Oregon past, that is most painful for a lot of people, still painful for a lot of people, and it's a part of the past that we're trying to, I believe, get rid of. And someone once said that perception is everything, and if there's one person out there in some place other than Oregon who perceives that because we would want to establish signs like this that they're not wanted for whatever reason, for whatever reason they, and however they might finish the sentence, then I think that's a problem for all of us. So kind of sound like I'm rattling on here, but I'm just deeply concerned about the irony in all of this week and the message that this conveys.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate your time to come out to testify. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
I'd like to call Robert Liberty from the Multnomah 1000 Friends. Welcome.
Thank you.
Finally, we might have some friends here.
Okay.
My name is Robert Liberty. I'm director of 1000 Friends of Oregon, and many of you may know that our organization was co-founded by Tom McCall and Henry Richmond in the last few months of Tom McCall's term as governor. I want to begin by recognizing those of you, in fact, all of you here today on this committee, who are doing something very important to honor the legacy of Tom McCall, and that's to defeat some very bad bills that have come before you in the last few weeks. And you honor it by demonstrating that the tradition of bipartisan support and concern for quality of life is still alive in the Oregon legislature. I can't necessarily say it's alive and well, but it is certainly alive. And I think that is a very important part of the Oregon tradition because Tom McCall thought concern for quality of life transcended party label. I want to begin by reading to you our position on population growth because it's something that our staff and board discussed over the course of several months in 1996, and we got the following statement. And I'd like it on the record to understand why we are neutral on this bill. From our foundation, 1000 Friends of Oregon's position has been to help Oregon manage growth, not to work on measures to curb population growth. We believe our effectiveness is attributable in part to focusing our work on this mission. We will continue to devote ourselves to helping Oregon manage its growth wisely rather than trying to affect the rate of population growth at the national, state, or local levels. This does not mean that we are ignorant of or indifferent to the consequences of population growth, nor that we will always be neutral with regard to particular efforts to promote or discourage population growth in communities or regions in Oregon. We think it's unwise for state policies and programs to promote job and population growth in areas already experiencing rapid population growth. Job and population growth should be promoted in areas with declining populations or unemployment that is significantly higher than the rest of the state. In these areas, state efforts to promote population growth may be appropriate if they are part of a broader economic stabilization and diversification effort. We believe there's merit in exploring coordinated regional approaches to the allocation of population growth between cities in a region. A regional approach can allow communities to reallocate growth among themselves in a way that is better for those communities in the region while fulfilling state policies on housing affordability, transportation, economic opportunity, and the protection of farm and forest lands and natural resources. And I'll provide a copy of this statement to the committee.
Thank you.
The third point I want to make is that one of the reasons people have concerns about population growth in the state of Oregon is the form it takes, the pattern of development. Yet people think there's a direct correlation between population growth and development. Well, there's a relationship, but there is not a direct correlation. Between 1970 and 1990, the population in metropolitan Chicago grew by 4%. 4%. Its land area grew by 46 to 55%. Kansas City metropolitan area, 29% population growth for the metropolitan area, 110% increase in land area. And Cleveland. Metropolitan Cleveland during this time lost, I don't remember the exact figure, I believe it was 6% of its population, and its land area grew by 20%. So to equate the expansion of urban development or rural development with population growth and think there's one-to-one, I think is mistaken. And I believe a lot of the opposition to population growth grows out of people's national appropriate concern about what's happening to the state of Oregon and the pattern of development that growth is taking. So the answer to your question, Senator Lim, are we ready for this population growth? Our organization gives an emphatic no. We are not ready for a whole variety of reasons. Now I want to cover a little bit about what McCall said exactly. Of course, McCall spoke on many occasions on this subject, but this is from Brent Wall's biography called Prior to Eden's Gate. In April 1971, he said to a meeting of tourist executives, "An office holder would have to be a political basket case to publicly screen for closure of tourism. What a paradox. The entire nation is now justifiably ababble about environmental threats. Everyone is shouting, stop talking and do something. Oregon does something and gets blasted for being inhospitable at worst, provincial at best, or is it the other way around? We are continuing to woo new industry. We have to have it. But we are not willing to take any industry at any price. The industry must come on our terms, play the game by our environmental rules, and be members of the Oregon family. We lose some this way, and we want to lose that kind of company." And then later on, when he was on a business recruitment trip, and this is very important, McCall went out to attract businesses to this state. He said, "We aren't being hostile or provincial. We are being prudent. It is not our intention to lure anyone to a promised land that becomes instead an environmental disaster. We're being realistic. We know we cannot support a human tidal wave of migration. We haven't the jobs for that kind of onrush. We haven't the facilities. We're determined to maintain our magnificent environment. It may sound presumptuous or immodest, but the context in which I pitch to you is this." Remember, he's on a business recruitment trip talking to business executives. "Oregon, accepting a few applications for location of branch offices by a carefully screened set of corporations with reputations for honoring the sanctity of the environment." When Tom McCall used the phrase quality of life, it was not some vague, vaporous statement. And he always said that we will have growth on Oregon's term, and it would be something that would contribute to the quality of life and build community. Now, you may detect a faint whirring sound coming from underground. And that is because Tom McCall is spinning at high speed in his grave right now because of the outrageous number of bills introduced in this legislature to undermine his legacy. 125 bills at last count to weaken everything that Tom McCall worked to build up because he believed we could have growth, we could have quality of life if it was managed and we set standards. And what those bills do is piece by piece pull away the standards, pull away the enforcement, and weaken our planning program. And I think McCall understood the relationship between what he said and his planning program. He could have, in his last term, worked on measures to stop people from moving here, to take, you know, tax capital investments or make it harder to move to Oregon. That isn't what he worked on. What did he work on? Senate Bill 100, to manage the growth that was coming in a way that would contribute and not detract from quality of life. And I think if he was alive today, he would be apoplectic, first of all. But I think he would be saying, the one thing we can agree on in this state is quality and high standards. And that growth is going to come, as he said, we need it. Those are his words, not 1,000 Friends' words. We need it, but it has to be on our terms. The tourism slogan is, Oregon, things look different here. If these bills pass, we can say, Oregon, things look exactly the same here. I'm not referring to your bill, Senator Lynn, but all these other 125 bills that you and your colleagues here today have voted against. So we'll be glad to answer questions.
Any questions? Okay. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I think you've done a very good job of capturing what Tom McCall was really trying to say, and I think that's true. I think maybe it was a poor choice of words, and that he was a great communicator, but I think that what he was thinking was what you're saying. So I think it's a good review of what Tom was really trying to do. The only other question I have for you and for your organization, this bill before us says you place a sign at the entrance to Oregon, each place, and the sign would say, "You're welcome to visit Oregon, but please don't stay." I guess my question is, how can you be neutral? Now, the other part I understand. I understand the overpopulation. I understand the air, the water, and the infrastructure and all that. But you are welcome to visit Oregon, but please don't stay. Are you really, really neutral on that statement?
Well, I guess it's the problem is that we have conflicting emotions of disagreeing with a founder who was trying to express a commonly held belief about concern about the future, at the same time also honoring his attitude that we plan for growth, we don't try and stop growth.
Yeah, see, I understand what you're doing there, but this is something different. This is a sign.
Well, the first part of it sounds like a pro-tourism sign to me, but I didn't understand the prior testimony.
But the police don't stay. In other words, you knew for the foot sign, but it's okay.
No, what we're trying to say is that we're both trying to honor our position statement, which is to be neutral in matters of population. I guess that's the answer.
Mr. Chair, but the question, I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just trying to get back to it.
I'm flattered you think this is going to make a big difference to his chances on Senate floor, Senator. You may be the only one who believes that.
Can you say snowball in hell?
Yeah. No, I believe Senator Corcoran, it might be snow lake.
I'm not touching that line.
But please don't say, what you're saying is you're neutral to that side being put up.
We don't have a position on this bill because we think it's directed at population growth, and we are neutral on population growth.
Have you considered politics? I know you're in it.
Well, yes, that's right. It's kind of hard to avoid.
I know. I understand. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you, Gordon.
The population that will grow in the state over the next little while with the overall change in demographics is the Latino population. And again, the resolution speaks to overpopulation as something that causes problems with infrastructure in the state. Overpopulation harms the air, water, other natural resources, et cetera. I'm struggling with how your organization could be neutral as well, given that, again, as our population changes and becomes more diverse, what does this say to those people who are brown, who will be coming into the state, about how we intend to welcome them? Again, perception is everything, depending on where you're sitting.
Well, Senator Gordley, I think you know about our concern that as growth occurs, the burdens and benefits are distributed fairly. We have a record of involvement in issues on everything from affordable housing and economic development. I think that speaks very clearly to our view about growth and attitude toward all New Oregonians, whether they're born here or come here. I guess we don't agree necessarily with the factual assumptions behind the statements that overpopulation in itself is the cause of those problems. I think it would be naive to say that planning can avoid and solve and address all of the problems. But one, we're not in our organization is not in a population limitation direction and so on business. We want to be clear about that. The clearest way is to be, we believe, neutral on these issues. And the second thing is that how growth is accommodated varies dramatically in the United States. I gave you those figures about the extent of suburban and urban sprawl related to population. The ratio in the Portland area is more like 1-to-1. So there are ways of doing a much better job. And I think before any, we ought to be focusing on things that are realistic and practicable to make life good for people who come here, either born or arrive, and that planning is one of the most important tools we have for doing that. So I guess I'm saying we're sticking with a neutral position. Our record on some of the issues you've raised is clear from our work, because we want to make the point that we are here to deal with managing growth, not limiting, directing, turning it aside. I also believe there's a lot of, I spoke on this on economic development issues in Florence on Friday, and I think a lot of the measures that are actually being proposed to try and affect population growth rate won't work anyway. And so we're going to end up fighting each other over things that I think have no practical difference.
Well, this isn't directed so much at Mr. Liberty and 1,000 Friends, but I actually want to defend the chair, because I think that Oregon tourism industry per se probably is not the correct opponent to this bill in the building. Really, the correct opponent to this would be maybe the building trades or I don't know that it would be even other industry, but I think that, there is a magic to Oregon, and I'm one of those ones that would never make the claim about staying out because I came here via Ireland, New Mexico, University of San Francisco, Vermont, and then arrived here in heaven, and I ain't moving. But, the fact is that the whole point about this state in terms of tourism is its mystique. I mean, I remember thinking about this state and knowing what I knew about this state in the 60s before I moved up here, and it really had some magic to it. It was appealing to a whole generation of young people, especially on the West Coast, that knew about it. And the same appeal that the Northeast had, that Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine had to kids growing up in the on the East Coast. But, I think that there's an argument to be made here that to the extent that we do sort of uncontrolled growth in this state, we change the very nature of what is magical about this state and what does draw tourism. So I don't agree with the chair's, slogan, and I won't support it, but I do think that that he needs to be defended in the sense that this is about a man who thinks about this state as a businessman and says, let's keep what's special about this state special. And I don't have any quarrel with that, frankly. Maybe it's the wrong vehicle, but I don't have any quarrel with it, per se. So I think the chair needs to bend. And as, in terms of people of color coming here, I mean, the fact of the matter is, Senator Gordley, I think that what we're going to see, I have a very Malthusian view of social economics in the coming times. And I think that Oregon is going to be an incredible attraction for people not only all over this country but from all over this world because of the quality of soil here, because of the water here, and I think that that this place will have an even bigger draw, and the place where people go when there is mass increase of population is urbanization. So it'll tend to be the effects on growth and the fights that Thousand Friends will be fighting will be somewhat similar to what they're fighting now. They won't be taking place in eastern Oregon. They'll be taking place here in the valley.
If I could, Senator Lim,
go ahead.
I think that the expression of concern about the future of the state, which is reflected both in this resolution and in your question about are we ready for this growth, is something that a lot of Oregonians share. And as I say, our answer that I take a lot of time to flesh out in terms of detail, our answer is clearly not. Whether you're brown or not, wherever you come from, whether you were born here or come here, we're not ready. And we can do a lot to make this place better despite or with the growth or because of the growth. And Senator Gorley, you may remember in the, you may have seen the Urban League's 50th anniversary publication, there's a photograph of Tom McCall there because he was aide to Senator Governor McKay, or McKay, I don't know if this is it correctly pronounced, McKay, and worked hard on civil rights legislation. So for him, it was never a matter of exclusivity. Everyone was welcome as Oregonians. But I think a certain amount of anxiety about our future, not a certain amount, a large amount of anxiety is justified right now because we have a great mystique, but we're not living up to our reputation right now. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. If anyone wants to hear McCall via tape delay, we have an audio history of Senate Bill 100 here.
Okay.
Oh, boy, that would really
Robert, I have one question.
That would bring me to Oregon.
Wow.
Well, we could package this committee hearing. That's an alternative.
I wouldn't listen to it if it was in Gaelic.
Okay, I have one question. Yes.
Oh, I was just going to say, Mr. Rubin,
you go ahead.
Yeah. You'll understand that next time your lobbyist comes to see me, because back then the center was neutral on the issue, won't you?
Well, I'll tell you, on a number of bills, we can appreciate that. In fact, we would like pledges from several senators to be neutral on the bill.
Okay, I like the specific questions. You mentioned that we are not ready. I know it's going to take a long time, but in 2-3 minutes, could you give us the why we are not ready, that the people moving in 25 years, that 1 million people are
here are four major points, quickly. One, we have not changed the fundamental pattern of urban development, so we're using lots of land that we don't need to use. the steel building in the 1970s and the 1990s. And that's something where the private sector has to work on its own and with government. A little bit can be forced by government. Second thing, we're still financing transportation, the transportation network, which is the framework for growth based on 1960s and 70s assumptions. Governor Kitzhaber has tried to change that, equalize investment between existing communities and new communities, and provide a greater variety of ways to travel. We've barely scratched the surface. We still think we can build our way out of congestion, and we're going to build our way into sprawl. Third point, there ought to be some permanence and stability in things like protection of farm and forest land and natural resources. Every single legislative session is what new thing can we build on farm and forest land? The timber industry has to think in terms of 50, 60, 80-year rotations. We ought to be thinking 80 years ahead on farmland and saying, at some point, this is no longer available for the next house, the next two house, the next two homes, and so on, and there ought to be an end to building more houses in our critical farm and forest lands. Fourth point is enforcement. You know, there's no line item called enforcement in the planning program. Enforcement's done by individual citizens challenging government actions they think violate the law. We need to get serious about this program and say it needs to be enforced. That ought to keep the next couple sessions busy, and we won't be neutral on any of those bills.
Okay. What was the first one I was distracted? What was the first one you mentioned?
The pattern of urban development, we're still building in the 1970s, big parking lots, low density, and also something I think is bad for society and the economy. Zoning is still being used to segregate people according to income, therefore also by race.
Okay. More questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Is there any other person like to testify on SJR-22? If not, we will close the public hearing. Are we ready for work session?
Mm-hmm. I thought Harry Carey
was a neutral. Okay, and I'd like to open the public hearing.
Not this time.
Okay.
Not this millennium.
I mean, okay.
Okay. Okay. What are you writing now?
Let's put up a little nice and easy, okay?
Well, I just...
Okay.
Okay,
I'd like
you there.
Yes. This is not assisted suicide for this period. Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing of Senate Bill 1221. This is just for the sake of to keep this bill alive. And Senator Cochran.
Good luck, yes. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for agreeing to hear this bill. This bill comes from a very serious issue that I observed down in Lane County. It comes from my past lives, both in law enforcement and in mental health. We watched the death and the trial of the parent in what's been considered one of the most horrible child murders in Oregon history, the death of Tesla and O'Cole that occurred in Lane County a couple of years back. It involved a methamphetamine crazed family that essentially tortured a young, I believe she was four, either three or four when she died, but it's one of the worst torture cases that the law enforcement folks had ever seen in the history of Oregon. And it had to do with sort of methamphetamine psychosis that these parents were under. They used a blowtorch on this child. It's just horrendous. I won't go into the details. But it got me thinking about what we needed to do to deal with the methamphetamine problem, because I consider it a far worse problem than any other drug categorically than we have in Oregon. It's worse than cocaine, it's worse than marijuana, it's worse than the psychotropic drugs, it's worse than alcohol, tobacco combined, because I believe it induces psychosis in people, and I think that we could get expert testimony, although I don't think we need to. I think that's an assumption that everybody makes. The next step then was to look at my district. My district basically is about 7,000 square miles that includes rural Lane County and North Douglas County.
and both are on the I-5 corridor. And in talking to the state police about the problem of methamphetamine labs in general, one of the points that they made was that the I-5 corridor, especially the rural areas in Lane County, are becoming known nationally as a hotbed for methamphetamine production. And the question of what we do about it, I went to the Oregon State Police to talk to them, and the problem with methamphetamine, they used to call it the poor man's cocaine because it was so accessible to folks. And the problem that I had as a politician in this building was living under a leadership that said we have a zero-sum budget here. We will not be creating any additional revenue to provide for additional services. But I felt in talking to the state police and my local law enforcement people that we have got to have some additional methamphetamine lab eradication dollars in the system. And we've got to have more programs, preschool programs, and now after-school programs have reached the highlight for these kids that are at risk, because until we get at the base roots of these problems, we are going to continue to have generations of victims coming through our system. And if you talk to any educator in the state, you will know that these kids are tremendously tough to deal with. And it doesn't matter what the ADM weighted rating is for kids with these special needs. These kids have horrendous problems, and it takes amazing amounts of resources to deal with them. So given that zero-sum game, I basically had to construct what I will openly admit is a very liberal interpretation of economic development and education as two uses of video lottery money. Basically, in doing my research to try to find a pot of money that would not come from the general fund and at the expense of other programs that we need so badly, I looked at trying to find a source of money that would not have an impact on basically small business working Oregonians. And I think I found that with the video lottery dollars that are available. $270 million is the take in the biennium for video poker. And we have a system that's set up to dole out the net profits taken from that by granting 35% of the first 200,000 of net profits, 30% of the next 200,000, 25% of the next, and 20% of the 600,000 to 800,000. These were new categories that had to be created. I think we can get the information from the Lottery Commission, but I think it was in the last biennium they created the 400,000 and above categories, because we hadn't seen such dramatic increases till then. So what I propose doing, Mr. Chair, in very simply, is grabbing $30 million out of that $270 million per biennium without affecting the small mom and pops. So I've changed the formula, and that is reflected in the amendments to 1221-1 that I've submitted, which would essentially do this. It would grant those video lottery retailers, video poker retailers, the first 300,000 they would get at the 35% rate. And then from that point up, it would be reduced to 10%. According to data from the Lottery Commission, that would capture $30 million. I would propose splitting that $30 million essentially four ways. A quarter of it would go for methamphetamine lab eradication directly through grants to interagency narcotics teams around the state. A quarter of it would go to DEQ to assist in the cleanup of these methamphetamine labs, because if any of you have ever served on a committee where you've heard testimony about these, I have in the Waste and Means Natural Resource Subcommittee in 95, horrendously expensive. Just to go in and basically shut down the operation and clean up can cost the local government, like my city of Cottage Grove, a town of 7,000, cost them up to about $10,000 just for the cleanup, not for anything sort of out in the future on this. So it's horrendously expensive. So a quarter of the money would go to DEQ for a fund for methamphetamine lab cleanup. A quarter of it would go for preschool programs. This one is a no-brainer. It's education, very clearly, for preschool programs for children at risk. As we've seen with Oregon benchmarks, we haven't come close to even meeting the benchmarks for the amount of Head Start positions we're funding. In addition, we have, in my community, for instance, a relief nursery that does tremendous work and does it with no state assistance at all, and is about to go under because of that. They need some assistance. It's a worthwhile issue for the state to take on. And the third category of preschool would be the Birth to Three program, which also does a tremendous job with at-risk children and at-risk parents. And then the last quarter of the money would essentially go to cities and counties for after-school programs, which in this session of the legislature we've actually heard a lot about. That's becoming a more and more popular target of programs because there's a spike in criminal activity among young kids after school, basically. And it's because their parents are both working, or if it's a single-parent family, that parent is working and there's no supervision. So you will probably hear testimony from the Lottery Commission. I was astounded to see the notion that there would be a $484,000 impact. I frankly have a hell of a time believing this, Mr. Chair, pardon my French, that it would cost $484,000 to change the computers over to determine how much would be paid out in the city of Poker. I think that number is exceptionally high. And they will also argue that the U.S. Constitution prohibition against impairment of contract would preclude the reduction of compensation payments under the current terms of contract that they have with these video lottery folks. I question that assumption. I would like to delve in that a little further. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity today to get this bill on the docket so we can have some serious discussion. I'm not wed to the fact that it has to come out of video lottery money, but I think it has to come. That's my basic point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Duncan.
I have two on the table, and these come from Senator Fisher, who had to leave to go to Roseburg, and so
okay.
I'll just ask his two questions. I think he kept them in the Roseburg Review, too. His
okay.
If Senate Bill 221 does raise revenue, does it require a two-thirds vote or 18 on the floor? And second, does legislative council feel that this bill needs to originate in the House?
I've had
dealt with those two issues.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I've had that discussion. Ms. Reeves and I have both independently had discussions with legislative council about this issue. It is legislative council's position that it is not revenue raising because it is dealing with revenues. It is simply cutting the pie in a different way. So it's not raising additional revenues. These are revenues that are raised already through video lottery. So it does not need to originate in the House, does not require a three-fifths vote. Additionally, I want to anticipate a question that has been raised regarding this, and that is, does appropriating part of this for law enforcement fall within economic development or education? I would submit that clearly parts of it do, the preschool, the after-school programs do. I would submit also very strongly, Mr. Chair, that given that my district has double-digit unemployment and very low income, that the knowledge nationwide that Oregon is a hotbed of methamphetamine production, it would clearly argue, and legislative council has said, Mr. Barkowski has said that he will come in here and make that point to you as well, that this is statutorily permissive in terms of economic development. So I don't believe the impediments that are created in terms of the cost of the computers, the question of whether this fits into economic development and education, and the question of whether it can't be implemented till 2004 are legitimate arguments.
Any other questions? Not Senator. Thank you very much.
Thanks
for sharing. Okay, we have a limited time, but I'd like to call Chris Lyon from the lottery and also the Ike McCracken. McCracken. Oh, okay. Okay. Mike, are you comfortable sitting together, or what arrangement do you like to make?
Chairman. Okay. Very sensible, but I'm not prepared to talk on any dog.
Okay, why don't you wait a little bit then? Let's lift up a lot of it then.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Chris Lyons. I'm the director of the Oregon Lottery, and with me today is David Hooper, our public affairs manager. I'm going to, we've had some conversations with Senator Corcoran on this bill, I'm going to sort of modify my testimony as we move through it. Senate Bill 1221 proposes changes to video retailer compensations for contracts issued after July 1st of 1999. The Senator has presented sort of the missing link, and so it's obvious that these changes would reduce the compensation paid to our retailers. As the members of the committee may recall from our previous testimony on retailer compensation, the Lottery Commission recently reduced video lottery compensation by about $6 million a year. Attached to the testimony is a fact sheet that compares the old and the new compensation structures. The new compensation structure that we adopted last year reduced the commission rates paid to our highest volume retailers down to 20%. It will also bring the average commission rate paid to our video lottery retailers to about 32% of net sales, which is the amount that's left after the prizes have been paid. If this were calculated in terms of all the video dollars played, the gross sales instead of the net, then the compensation rate would be about 3% on each sale. The average amount paid to a video lottery retailer in 1998 was $72,000 per year. To better understand the video lottery compensation in Oregon, it may be helpful for the members of the committee to know what level our compensation rates are as compared to operators in other jurisdictions that have video lottery. In Delaware, the operators receive 75% of net sales. In Louisiana, retailers receive 32.5%. In Montana, the retailers and operators share 85% of net sales. In South Dakota, retailers receive 50%. In West Virginia, the operators receive 47%. As you can see, Oregon's average video lottery retailer compensation rate of 32% is actually at the bottom of the pay scale spectrum. The other part of this equation is the amount of net receipts the states receive. The state of Oregon receives 56% of net receipts as profit. That money goes, as you know, to economic development, education, parks, and salmon. Delaware, on the other hand, receives only 25%. The state of Montana gets 15%. South Dakota gets 50%, and West Virginia, 30%. So the state of Oregon receives the largest percentage of any state with video lottery. Statutes require that the lottery maximize revenue while paying its contractors a fair and reasonable rate of return. I believe the Lottery Commission is in the best position to strike the balance and has done so with a new contract and compensation rate. I recognize that video poker and retailers who offer that game are unpopular in some circles, but we should keep in mind the vital role retailers have in generating profits for the state. Without retailers, there would be no lottery sales or profits for economic development, education, parks, or salmon. Given our statutory obligation to pay retailers a fair and reasonable rate, together with findings from KPMG, their independent analysis, the lottery negotiated in good faith with its retailers to create a mutually beneficial contract. Based on the regulatory strength and legal soundness of that final document, the Lottery Commission adopted a six-year contract that was effective July 5th of 1998. As provided for in SB 1221, any contemplated changes that would reduce video lottery commission rates could only apply to future retailers. And in my conversations with the senator, I would encourage you to check with the attorneys and your own counsel in that regard. Any projected additional transfer amounts based on the assumptions of the new contract issued during the next budget cycle would, of course, be speculative and somewhat unreliable, further creating two disparate classes of retailers
could create confusion and deception in the marketplace. It would devalue businesses and therefore encourage retailers to manipulate our application process to circumvent the lower rates as these businesses are put up for sale. For example, rather than selling the business outright, the new owners could simply be added to existing contracts with the previous contract holder, remaining as an owner on paper with only minimal holdings in the business. What I'm just trying to point out to you here is some of the difficulties associated with creating two different commission rates for two different classes of retailers. Another consequence to think about for the retailers who receive the lower rate of compensation is that they may be tempted to more actively promote video poker sales to make up the difference. This is another factor that you should consider in creating this public policy. The rest of my testimony, at least a couple paragraphs, talk about the technical issues associated with it, and in most cases the senator has dealt with those issues. I still think there maybe are a couple of issues you may want to check with counsel on with regard to where the money would go, those things that aren't clearly tied to education or economic development. Lastly, I'd like to talk about the fiscal impact just a moment. It will, in fact, take lengthy and some costly reprogramming of our computers to install the second class of retailer compensation. We just installed a new computer system and are currently preparing for a Y2K. When we created the fiscal impact statement, it was presuming that we would have to have this work done by July 1st, and that is a good portion of the cost. Our vendor does most of this work, and we compete with other jurisdictions for programming time. And the best estimate on a non-accelerated path would be April of 2000. If this bill went into effect July 1st and the new structure went into effect for a second class of retailer, we would have to prepare some of these checks manually and override the computer systems. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Lottery Commission, and staff have worked hard to analyze and balance all the factors that must be considered in developing a fair and reasonable compensation structure for our retailers. Oregon pays its retailers less than any jurisdiction and receives the highest rate of return. Although the legislature is clearly within your authority to make this policy change, we would caution that you think through creating two classes of retailers and who receive different rates. That's really our testimony, and David and I will answer any questions you might have regarding this issue.
Any questions? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I have several questions. The lottery will tell you that Oregon's video lottery commission rate is lower than other states, but KPMG has said flatly, quote, no other state has a video lottery arrangement that is similar enough to Oregon to make comparisons relevant. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, every state has a different structure, and there is no apple-to-apple comparison, so that KPMG statement is true in being able to compare apples and apples. And, and what I was attempting to do is give you a range, you know, considering all of the variety of business operations that are out there. Some of those are closer to ours than others that were really in that list.
Okay. My second question is, even assuming that $484,000 was correct, couldn't we construct amendments that would say that that would come out of the first $30 million of revenue that we're moving over?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, yes, you could.
So it wouldn't be any additional cost to say. Okay. When I talk to you folks about restructuring, and I may have misspoken my testimony, so I want to be real clear here, that the way to get potentially $30 million is to have the zero to 200,000 commission rate stay the same, 35%, and have the 200,000 to 300,000
stay the same, 30%. And it would be a change from 300,000 up that would be 10%. So I wanted to clarify that. When I spoke to you, I believe you told me that by going that would only impact 45% of the 800 retailers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carfin, if that's what we said, that's correct. And again, that was an estimate based on turnover. We have some additional information where we actually went back now and took a look and said, okay, how many of our retailers are turning over in a year? And I think that number is, in fact, less than 40. I'm going to let David do that now.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Hooper. I'm Public Affairs Manager. Senator Corcoran, Mr. Chairman, I believe those figures that we gave you and that analysis was based on a change in compensation that would affect all retailers.
Oh, I would assume it would have to.
And not just new contracts.
That's right.
As your bill is written, it would only apply to new contracts after July 1st. You know, last year, calendar year 98, we processed 228 video lottery applications. 98 of those were new installations, new retailers. The balance of those were change of ownership, sale of business applications, and most of those were partnerships or corporations, limited liability companies, and those are the ones that would fall into the kind of that gray area that Director Lyons mentioned, where people may try to circumvent the new rates by simply adding partners rather than selling the business outright. So,
well, I'm a little confused, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. Where does my bill say that it creates a two-part payoff?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim, I'm reading Section 6 of the bill, which is lines 39 through 41.
Okay.
Which says it would not apply to contracts entered into before. So.
And is it your opinion that, I think I did this after talking to you guys, is it your opinion that you have stated, or it's stated in the staff major summary, and I presume it must have come from you, that the U.S. Constitution's prohibition against impairment of contracts precludes the reduction of current compensation payments.
Yeah.
Is that your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, based on our advice from our legal counsel, that is correct.
And your legal counsel is like in-house or just AG's
office?
The
Attorney General's office.
Okay. Thank you.
The Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, going to the 40%, we have about 1,800 video retailers, and if we're turning over about 230 of those a year, you're better than I at those kind of mathematics, but I think that's somewhat less than 40. So I just wanted to put that in your mind in terms of the turnover based on the way the contract is. The way the bill is written today.
All right.
Okay. Thanks. Any questions? If not, thank you very much. I do appreciate it. At this time, I'd like to call the Mayor Mike Crane, and I want to thank you for waiting so long to testify. And, you know, we appreciate very much.
No free beer here, Mayor.
No, nowhere. And I understand the disappointment they may have for some people.
Mayor, we'd like to welcome you, and you are...
Senator Lim, if you don't mind, may I introduce Mayor Swain and give a little bit of background?
Of course.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities. During the interim period, the last interim period, and after the incident at Thurston High School, the League of Cities sponsored a committee called the At-Risk Youth Committee. The committee addressed community needs about the issues of youth and at-risk youth across the state in our large and small communities. The committee membership included representatives from cities, counties, school districts, school boards, state legislators, the governor's office, and many other interested parties. A list of issues and gaps were developed, which the League and committee members continue to work on. Mayor Swain has been a member of that committee and is now co-chair of that committee. One of the issues that was repeatedly discussed by the At-Risk Youth Committee and endorsed by the League's Legislative Committee was the need to provide cities with a sustainable source of funding for after-school and school break programs, which are especially vital, as you heard from Senator Corcoran, during the 3 to 5 o'clock period of time when the majority of juvenile crime occurs. I'd like to take this time to welcome Mayor Swain to talk about the issue in depth.
Welcome, Neil Gray. Thank you very much, Chairman Lynn. My name for the record is Mike Swain. I am the mayor of Salem and also a member of the board of League of Oregon Cities, as well as the co-chair with Mayor Torrey from Eugene of the At-Risk Youth Special Committee. I've given you a one-page statement of my testimony for a person who comes from a profession that's paid by the word. I'm sure you can appreciate the fact that I'm trying to be as economical as possible. And given the lateness of the hour, I just want to touch on a couple of the ideas there and certainly entertain questions. Without any question, I think one of the most important aspects of any community is the responsibility to imbue its youth with the kinds of value systems that perpetuate a good, sound, and healthy community. And I think that what we're experiencing in many of our communities, at least here in the city of Salem, we're experiencing it, and I think we're not unlike other communities, is that there's an increasing disconnect between our youth and their sense of responsibility for the communities in which they reside. There are some that say that one of the best indicators of the health of the community is the health of its youth within the community. And someone once said that the youth are really the canary in the mine shaft of their communities. They are an indicator of how healthy the community is. The irony is that in order to have healthy youth, you need to have a healthy community. In order to have a healthy community, you need to have healthy youth. And it comes down to finances. Empirical evidence shows that the period of 3 to 6 p.m. in the afternoon is the most critical period of time in terms of keeping kids out of trouble. Here in the city of Salem, we have thousands, not just hundreds, but thousands and thousands of kids that come home every night after school to an empty house. Some don't stay in a house. Some never get to the house. They go out to the streets and into trouble. What we also know is that cities have been particularly hard hit by the progression of tax limitation measures 5, 47, and 50. And when you have to compare your general fund expenditures in terms of fire and police services on the one hand and parks and recreation, library, and social services on the other, it's the latter that has been cut. And I think this is being experienced throughout the entire state of Oregon. So just when we need to spend more money to invest in our youth, and especially in this after school period of time, we find that communities at the local level are faced with ever-declining revenues in which to do it. So I'm here on behalf of cities. I'm here on behalf of this particular city to urge you to support Senate Bill 1221. It's a good measure, and it is an important one in terms of investing for the health of our communities, not only today, but for years to come.
Okay. Any questions? Answered. Duncan?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I think it's rather impressive. I happen to sit on the Education Committee, and the mayor of Eugene was before our committee the other day, and today we have the mayor of the city of Salem. And to see our mayor is taking this kind of a response to dealing with young people, I think is really is great, and I'm impressed.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Nick, any question, any comment? But thank you very much for what you are doing, especially for the youth, and I do appreciate it. You are volunteering on this great job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pretty good. Okay, with that, I think the time is coming short. We are going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 1221, and then for the sake of to divide the bills we have, we would like to have a public hearing. Which one is it? Senate 1132, open public hearing, and then I'm going to close up the public hearing on 1132. So, and I thank you for those that waited for the last deal, but we will have the next time. I think it's 5 o'clock, we need to close. So if there is any other business.
I think we have a couple of people in the back of the room looking at us quizzically, trying to figure out what we're doing with 1132 and who would like some direction on what's going to happen with the bill, Mr. Chair. So we expect that the bill's going to come back.
It's going to come back. That's the only way we can keep the bill revived, we have to tap. Otherwise, the bill will be permanently dead. Mm-hmm. So that's what we are trying to do.
Okay.
And since I have no other business, then we'll close. We'll again.
Thank you.
Switch out.
Yeah.